lies this hour. The Pentagon announces the deployment of 2,000 U.S. troops to Poland and Germany amid heightened tensions with Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. planning to deploy a missile destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE after it fired Patriot interceptors to repel a Yemeni missile strike on the Persian Gulf state. And Turkey says dozens of its warplanes and drones have pounded the positions of Kurdish militants in northern Iraq and Syria. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The U.S. Defense Department says that it will deploy around 3,000 more troops to Eastern Europe amid mounting tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine. The Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby says the new deployment includes 2,000 troops, which will be headed to Europe in the coming days. Plus 1,000 soldiers who are currently based in Germany will be moving to Romania, a southern neighbor of Ukraine. The troops are in addition to the around 8,500 American soldiers who are put on alert near the Ukrainian borders. That is while Washington accuses Moscow of fabricating the context of invasion on Ukraine, citing the deployment of Russian troops for its claim. However, Russia denies the accusation, saying that it has piled up its troops on its own soil, purely for defensive purposes in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. In the meantime, a war of words escalates between the UK and Russia, as rifts between the two countries continue to widen over Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov described the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as someone who is utterly confused. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova also accused British officials of stupidity and ignorance. Elsewhere, the Russian Deputy Ambassador to the UN described British diplomacy as absolutely worthless.
There is always room for diplomacy, but frankly, we don't trust British diplomacy. I think in recent years, British diplomacy has shown that it is absolutely worthless in such issues. This hysteria doesn't stop. It's absolutely happening in the heads of Western politicians.
Dmitry Polyansky accused the West of exaggerating the number of Russian forces who are present along the country's border with Ukraine. On Tuesday, the UK premier, during his visit to Kiev, said the presence of Russian troops poses danger to Ukraine. The UK is among some Western countries that claim that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine. But such a stance appears to be contradictory, as France believes that there are no indications that Russia is ready to take military action against its neighbor. The Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba also says Russia has not yet massed enough forces to mount a full-scale invasion. Meanwhile, the U.S. is growing more engaged in the war in Yemen. The Pentagon is preparing to send fifth-generation fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates in the wake of the Yemeni strikes deep inside the Persian Gulf state. The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Washington will also deploy guided missiles destroyer USS Cole to Abu Dhabi. The U.S. will continue to provide early warning intelligence to the UAE. 2 days ago, Washington also intercepted a Yemeni projectile headed for the UAE. The Yemeni army has warned that it will continue to strike the Emirates as long as it keeps targeting Yemeni people. On Monday, Yemeni armed forces targeted a number of sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. The UAE is part of the Saudi coalition that's been waging a bloody war in Yemen for 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed directly from the war, or indirectly from hunger and disease. We reached out to political commentator Jason Unruha to hear his perspective on the latest warning that the Yemeni army has given the United Arab Emirates. Here's what he had to tell us.
The UAE seems to be relatively good to go along with it, to give them whatever kind of support, at least political support to some degree, and I highly suspect material support in the background or whatever form that it might take, and that this, of course, would lead the Yemenis to bring the war to the UAE, as we have seen at least one occasion. And then, you know, we're having them say that they're not afraid to strike out at basically anyone who's going to support the destruction of their country and the slaughter of their people. So maybe because I'm not really a war strategist kind of person, but it does seem like Saudi Arabia is looking for help. I mean, that at least that's how it appears to my eyes. I mean, that wasn't how it was done at the beginning, but this change has been made. So I think that it is a change to some degree, but exactly what it is probably only in the heads of the Saudi planners themselves.
The Iraqi military has condemned Turkey's deadly airstrikes against suspected Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. The military calls the Turkish infiltration into Iraqi airspace as a violation of the country's sovereignty. Separately, an Iraqi security media cell affiliated to the Prime Minister's office has criticized Ankara. It urges Turkey to respect the principle of good neighborliness and international regulations. Meanwhile, the Turkish Defense Ministry confirmed that dozens of its warplanes and drones pounded what it called bases of the PKK and YPG Kurdish groups in Iraq and in Syria. The attacks have left a number of people dead, injuring, although the exact number of casualties remains unknown. Turkey views both groups as terrorists and has carried out numerous attacks against them. The Syrian government has not reacted to the Turkish aerial raids. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Washington's policy of maximum pressure has failed to achieve its goals.
When the Americans openly acknowledge that they have failed in their maximum pressure policy, an ignominious failure, this is a victory for the Iranian nation.
Raisi said that Iran's policy of resistance has offset the U.S. pressure. Raisi made the remarks during a visit to the mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Back in 2018, former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 deal between Iran and world powers and intensified a campaign of sanctions to force Tehran to negotiate a new agreement. Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-Day Dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been present at this year's ceremonies and has filed this report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad Airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-Day Dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals, no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Mourners in the Iranian city of Qom have held a memorial procession for the prominent cleric, Ayatollah Lutfullah Safi Golpaygani, passed away on Tuesday. Government officials, religious scholars, seminary students were also in attendance. The 103-year-old cleric died from cardiac arrest. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued a message of condolence on the demise of the senior cleric. Ayatollah Golpayegani was a pillar in the field of Islamic jurisprudence, as well as a master in mysticism and practical ethics. Over his decades-long career, he trained hundreds of researchers and wrote dozens of books. He was a former member of the Constitutional Council that vets candidates for public offices. The body of Ayatollah Golpayegani will be laid to rest in Iraq's holy city of Karbala. The British Interior Minister reacts to comments made by the French president, blaming the UK for the deaths of migrants. Priti Patel says Emmanuel Macron's comments are, quote, absolutely wrong. She rejects Macron's claims that the UK's immigration policy encourages people to risk their lives crossing the channel from France. On Tuesday, Macron accused London of hypocrisy, adding that it was morally responsible for those who died. He also blamed Prime Minister Boris Johnson for putting lives in danger because of his migration policy. The rout between France and Britain has escalated since the sinking of a dinghy boat last year, which led to the deaths of 27 migrants. Both countries blame each other for casualties of migrants crossing the English Channel. The pressure piling up on Britain's Prime Minister in a leadership challenge, now a senior conservative lawmaker is joining the chorus of critics, saying that he will submit a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson.
But it's not the previous battles that matter. It's the domestic and international ones ahead of us that count. And the question now is for all of us, is the Prime Minister the best person to lead the party moving forward?
Tobias Elwood says the Partygate scandal is distracting the government at a time of international crisis. He urged Johnson to call a vote of confidence rather than wait for MPs to trigger the process. Elwood also admitted that the Conservative Party is slipping into a very ugly place. The British Prime Minister is under fire after the release of a partial version of an internal inquiry. The report has described a series of lockdown breaching parties held at Johnson's residence and government offices as a serious failure. Johnson could be removed as a Tory leader if 54 of the 360 Conservative MPs submit letters of no confidence to the party. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in London, Syed Pourreza. He says collecting letters of no confidence is just the beginning of a lengthy process to remove Prime Minister Boris Johnson from office.
The key question here now is whether or not enough Conservative MPs have handed in their letters of no confidence to the so-called 1922 committee of backbenchers. But the magical number is 54. Once that happens, you're looking at a no-confidence vote being triggered. And when that happens, the Prime Minister will have to win the trust or the vote of half of the Conservative MPs in Parliament. That's 181. But again, he's confronted with so many crises. You're looking at the Russia-Ukraine crisis. He's trying to tough talk on Russia. He's announced policies as far as relations with the EU, trying to deflect attention from the problem that has befallen him and his government over the past couple of weeks, if not longer. This is a serious challenge.
The Eurozone's inflation hits a new record high, extending pain for consumers and piling up further pressure on the European Central Bank. According to the statistics agency, Eurostat, the cost of living in the 19-member monetary bloc soared to over 5% in January, up from the previous month. The rise has been driven by raising demand for energy, including electricity usage. The European Central Bank is holding a meeting to discuss the issue. That is while the ECB chief, Christine Lagarde, has expressed optimism, saying the inflationary pressure is transitory. Experts say, however, that the inflation has become a source of anxiety in the Eurozone. Meanwhile, Europe is also facing a threat of energy disruption amid escalating tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine. COVID-19 infections hit record highs in several European countries amid growing concerns over the fast-spreading Omicron variant. Germany logs more than 208,000 infections in one single day, pushing the total past 10 million mark. The Czech Republic also registers its highest daily tally with over 57,000 cases. Denmark is another European country with a daily average of around 50,000 infections. It's also the first country on the continent that has lifted COVID-related restrictions despite Omicron's surge. Meanwhile, France also loosens several of the restrictions imposed to curb the COVID surge. The easing curbs, however, come despite an advisory by the World Health Organization that restrictions should be removed slowly and with caution. A correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says the Israeli blockade is taking an ever more severe toll on the Palestinian healthcare system and inflaming the coronavirus crisis in the besieged enclave.
The situation in Gaza is extremely grim. Yesterday, the director of Shifa Hospital said that he expects that there is at least one case in every house in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli blockade continues to take its toll on the enclave. A few days ago, the Minister of Health announced that Israel has been preventing the entry of testing equipment and testing kits, as well as surgical hospital equipment into the Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has complicated all aspects of life in Gaza, especially in the health sector. At least 1,100 people have died directly because of the Israeli blockade. And also, Gaza suffers from shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, and also the Israeli regime refuses or places tight restrictions on the exit permits to chronic patients who seek treatment in the occupied West Bank or in Al-Quds, Arash.
Rescue operations are underway in Quito, the capital of Ecuador, following record rainfall and landslides that have caused widespread destruction. At least 24 people are dead, 12 missing, and nearly 50 others injured. Quito Mayor's office has set up shelters to help the affected families. You can see the scale of damage in these images. People stuck in the mud, and the torrents of water sweeping away vehicles, trees, and utility poles. According to weather experts, Monday's torrential rains have been the heaviest to hit the South American country's capital in two decades. Severe downpours in Ecuador have been causing river overflows and similar incidents since October. Officials are now warning that the mudslides could further continue. And that is it for World News. Do stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week, and once again, U.S.-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Daniel Larrison, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "The Saudi Coalition War on Yemen Claims More Victims." Stay tuned for more. The war on Yemen has claimed dozens more innocent victims in the last week, and once again, U.S.-made weapons were used to commit the atrocity. The death toll from a coalition airstrike on a detention facility filled with migrants in northern Yemen has risen to at least 87 people, and hundreds more were injured in the attack. Fragments of the weapon found in the wreckage were identified as coming from ammunition manufactured by Raytheon. A separate airstrike in Hodeidah knocked out Yemen's internet connectivity, which has cut Yemenis off from remittance payments and compromised ability of humanitarian aid agencies to provide relief. At the same time, the coalition blockade has tightened and worsened the country's fuel crisis. As it has done since the war began almost 7 years ago, the Saudi coalition punishes the population of Yemen, and it still enjoys total impunity for its many crimes. The U.S. did not condemn the atrocity at the detention facility, nor did it criticize the Saudi coalition perpetrators for the massacre. All that the Biden administration could muster in response was to say that they are deeply concerned and that the escalation in fighting was of great concern. U.S. Secretary Blinken made a point of calling the earlier attack on Abu Dhabi deliberate without reaching the same conclusion about the much deadlier coalition airstrikes. This is unfortunately consistent with the Biden administration's overall handling of relations with the Saudi and Emirati regimes, which never face any consequences in Washington for crimes they have committed in Yemen or elsewhere. It is a measure of the absurdity and lopsided nature of the United States debate over Yemen that the only party to the conflict that is being considered for any U.S. punitive measures are the Ansarullah movement. The United Arab Emirates is demanding that the U.S. redesignate the popular Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization, and Biden has said he will consider doing so. It was the Biden administration that previously lifted the designation last year because they understood that the sanctions that came with a designation would be a death sentence for millions of Yemenis. But now there is pressure on Biden to endorse a policy of collective punishment against a population that is already experiencing mass starvation and famine. Yemen has already been suffering from the effects of coalition blockade, an economic war since 2015, and sanctions would be a new and heavy burden. The United States regime has been squarely on the side of the aggressors in this conflict, and it continues to shield them from the retaliation that their intervention has caused. As long as the United States supports and protects the Saudi and Emirati regimes, the harder it will be to end the war and the devastating humanitarian crisis that have already claimed more than 377,000 lives.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. it's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me spend a little bit of time discussing the verses from Surah Taha, verses 77 up to verse 91. I think is very relevant to us and the anniversary of the revolution. This is part of the story of Musa and Banu Israel and Fir'aun. The story of Musa and Fir'aun and Musa and Banu Israel, the children of Israel, has been mentioned in the Holy Quran many times. In each section, a certain part of it is more elaborate, is more extended. Certain other parts are either skipped or not mentioned or mentioned briefly. In this chapter, there are other parts mentioned as well. The parts I read start from the point where لَقَدْ أَوْحَيْنَا إِلَىٰ مُوسَىٰ أَنْ أَسْرِ بِعِبَادِي فَاضْرِبْ لَهُمْ طَرِيقًا فِي الْبَحْرِ يَبَسًا. We revealed upon Musa, gave him a message, أَنْ أَسْرِ بِعِبَادِي, travel with my ibad, with my slaves, Banu Israel, at night. Isra is traveling at night. فَضْرِبْ لَهُمْ, and you will get to a bahar. This is, again, it's very concise. In other chapters, it talks about this section, what happened, them leaving the city, and then getting there, and then the conversations between Banu Israel and Musa, and then seeing Fir'aun come, and then, this is a concise version, this part of it is very concise. فَضْرِبْ لَهُمْ, then when you get there, you open a path in the bahar. According to the other verses that we have in other chapters regarding this, that apparently was not something that he was told initially. The wahy came to leave the city. Then when they got there, the command was to stay there. They waited there. Fir'aun came. Banu Israel started to panic. They're seeing Fir'aun. They think they're going to be ruined. There's nowhere to go. At that point, God tells Musa to touch the bahar, that sea, with his staff, and a path open. فَضْرِبْ لَهُمْ طَرِيقًا فِي الْبَحْرِ يَبَسًا. This is going to be a dry path. You don't have to worry what you're stepping into. And لَا تَخَافُ دَرَكًا وَلَا تَخْشَى. You should not have any fear of any fall, any pit. And you should not have any worry. خَوْف إِنْ خَشْيَى. Relatively the same term. Some details I want to skip on that. So basically, Fir'aun, Musa took Banu Israel based on God's revelation, God's message to him. They crossed the Bahr, the sea. فَأَتْبَعَهُمْ فِرْعَوْنُ بِجُنُودِهِ. Fir'aun with his army and military followed them. فَغَشِيَهُمْ مِنَ الْيَمِّ مَا غَشِيَهُمْ. The sea covered them. What of the sea covered them? Covered them. Okay, in other words, drown. وَأَضَلَّ فِرْعَوْنُ قَوْمَهُ وَمَا هَدَى. And Fir'aun misled his people, and he did not guide them. Up to this point, this is a summary. Now, before this verse, Musa and Harun going to Fir'aun, and then what happened there, all of that is discussed. But here, this is a summary of the escape and the release, the point where Banu Israel, after generations of being chained, being enslaved, being mistreated, living under a government that suppresses their religion, their religious identity, abuses them, kills them for their views, for their belief, after so long generations have been struggling there, finally they're relieved. Who relieved them? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through a messenger, Musa. In a most miraculous way. Okay. I want to pause here, draw a parallel and comparison to the revolution, to this. We believe generally that anything that happens in the world is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, His will is manifesting, His mashi'ah, ma yasha', Anytime we see anything, we should say, MashaAllah, this is what God willed. This is what God wanted. Everything is like that. There are certain times, however, that as the instance of Banu Israel, that God himself says, his hand for us is more visible. And he calls them Ayyamullah, the day of Allah. In other words, it's so bright and so clear that God did this, that it's like daytime, it's that clear, as opposed to nighttime where things happen, you just don't see it. When it's pitch black, things are happening, things are moving, the sun is moving, the earth is moving, it's pitch black, you don't see. There's certain times that that's more evident. The revolution after the entirety of the Muslim world is in shackles, in chains, suppressed, the clergy of Muslimin from whatever sect that's actually remnants of the teachings of the Prophet, be it Sunni or Shia, they're all under the control, the authority, the iron fist of the colonialist kafir powers of the world. Whether it's Azhar in Egypt, whether it is the Hausa in Najaf, the Hausa in Qom, the clergy schools and the clergy in Turkey, the clergy in wherever you can imagine, it's all under the authority and in shackles provided and created by the colonialists. The cities of Islam, Mecca, Medina, under a British puppet, in other words, under the authority of the British. Al Saud represented the British. And later the Americans. This is how Muslimin were living. Israel, the Zionist government, officially took that land, even kicked all the Muslimin out, killed many of them, and said, we're even changing the name of this land to Israel. The rest of it through puppet governments, all Muslimin throughout the world, now under the control and authority of kuffar. Their religion is being attacked in so many different ways. The center of the Sunni Islamic government, which was the Ottoman Empire, the center of it was current day Turkey. The clergy could not wear their clergy clothes. The women had to remove their hijab. Their script was changed. They had Arabic script just like Iran does, just like Pakistan does. We use Arabic script. They changed that to Western script. Now, Turkish people, most of them, they cannot read their own Turkish works prior to the period when the colonialists. Hijabs were removed in Iran forcefully. All the rules of God were fought against. This is what was happening to all Muslimin worldwide. In one part of the Muslim lands, for all Muslimin, the shackles were removed. People were freed. Starting with that part. And that was very much clearly miraculous and divinely guided. Very, very evident. Don't hear it from me. Don't take it from me. Go back and find whatever documentaries. Everyone is caught by surprise. Then when you read the details of who did what did Imam Khomeini say, what did he do, what steps did he take, what did people do, how could this have happened in this way without a divine guidance that is guiding the mind of the leader and those involved in it? That's another for another time. This was very miraculous. Clearly Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed. What I'm emphasizing on, I keep saying all Muslimin. When the revolution succeeded, again, go back and read that. All Muslimin were extremely happy. they all saw it as the victory of Islam at that time. Everyone, Shia, Sunni. In a matter of days, the Palestinians, they came to the Islamic Republic, met with the leaders. The Israeli embassy was changed into a Palestinian embassy. Right when the revolution succeeded, the Israeli embassy was taken out. We don't have such a country. There's no such government. There's no embassy. They had to leave. And when the Palestinians came, the embassy was given to them. That was their embassy, and it still is. Palestinians came very happy. Pakistan was the first government, and I think the next day, second day after the revolution succeeded, recognized the ambassador in Pakistan, gave a talk. I think it was broadcasted on the television. It was in Farsi. And they were the first to recognize the Islamic Republic of Iran. And you can see the joy in everyone, all these Muslimin that are getting that news. Everyone is extremely happy. Why? Because they're all mu'minin. They all see this as a victory of Islam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New accounts show that former President Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in plans developed by outside advisors to use national security agencies to seek evidence of fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Maggie Haberman, Michael Schmidt, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Had Role in Weighing Proposals to Seize Voting Machines. Six weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Donald Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states, three people familiar with the matter said. Rudy Giuliani did so, calling the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the voting machines. Donald Trump pressed Rudolph Giuliani to make that inquiry after rejecting a separate effort by his outside advisors to have the Pentagon take control of the machines. And the outreach to the Department of Homeland Security came not long after Donald Trump, in an Oval Office meeting with Attorney General William Barr, raised the possibility of whether the Justice Department could seize the voting machines, a previously undisclosed suggestion that William Barr immediately shot down. The new accounts show that Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines, as he grasped unsuccessfully for evidence of fraud that would help him reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the episodes. The existence of proposals to use at least three federal departments to assist Donald Trump's attempt to stay in power has been publicly known. The proposals involving the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security were codified by advisors in the form of draft executive orders. But the new accounts provide fresh insight into how the former president considered and to some degree pushed the plans, which would have taken the United States into uncharted territory by using federal authority to seize control of the voting systems run by states on baseless grounds of widespread voting fraud. The people familiar with the matter were briefed on the events by participants or had first-hand knowledge of them. The accounts about the voting machines emerged after a weekend when Donald Trump declared at a rally in Texas that he might pardon people charged in connection with the storming of the Capitol last 6th of January if he were re-elected. In a statement issued after the rally, Donald Trump also suggested that his Vice President Mike Pence could have personally overturned the election by refusing to count delegates to the Electoral College who had vowed to cast their votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. The new information helps to flesh out how the draft executive orders to seize voting machines came into existence and points in particular to the key role played by a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron. According to people familiar with the accounts, Phil Waldron, shortly after the election, began telling associates that he had found irregularities in vote results that he felt were suggestive of fraud. He then came up with the idea of having a federal agency like the military or the Department of Homeland Security confiscate the voting machines to preserve evidence. Phil Waldron first proposed the notion of the Pentagon's involvement to Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, whom he says he served with in the Defense Intelligence Agency. The plans were among an array of options that were placed before Donald Trump in the tumultuous days and weeks that followed the election, developed by an ad hoc group of lawyers like Sidney Powell and other allies including Michael Flynn and Phil Waldron. The group often found itself at odds with Rudy Giuliani and his longtime associate Bernard Kerik, as well as with Donald Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his team. Around the same time that Donald Trump brought up the possibility of having the Justice Department seize the voting machines, for example, he also tried to persuade state lawmakers in contested states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to use local law enforcement agencies to take control of them. People familiar with the matter have confirmed. The state lawmakers refused to go along with the plan. The meeting with William Barr took place in mid to late November, when Donald Trump raised the idea of whether the Justice Department could be used to seize voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. Donald Trump told William Barr that his lawyers had told him that the department had the power to seize voting machines as evidence of fraud. Donald Trump mentioned a specific state that had used machines built by Dominion voting systems where his lawyers believed there had been fraud, although it is unclear which state Donald Trump was referring to. William Barr, who had been briefed extensively at that point by federal law enforcement officials about how the theories being pushed by Donald Trump's legal team about the Dominion voting machines were unfounded, told Trump that the Justice Department had no basis for seizing the voting machines because there was no probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. It was only after several early options were exhausted that Phil Waldron pitched the idea of using other parts of the federal government to seize the machines to both Rudolph Giuliani and members of the Trump legal team, and also to Michael Flynn and his own associates, including Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne, a wealthy business executive who funded many of the efforts to challenge the election. Phil Waldron, who owns a bar and distillery outside Austin, Texas, was previously best known for having circulated a 38-page PowerPoint presentation to lawmakers and White House aides that was filled with extreme plans to overturn the election. Rudolph Giuliani was vehemently opposed to the idea of the military taking part in the seizure of voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. The conflict between him and his legal team and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne came to a dramatic head on 18th of December 2020 during a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office at the White House. At that meeting, Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell presented Donald Trump with a copy of the draft executive order authorizing the military to oversee the seizure of machines. After reading it, Donald Trump summoned Rudolph Giuliani to the Oval Office, according to one person familiar with the matter. When Rudy Giuliani read the draft order, he told Donald Trump that the military could be used only if there was clear-cut evidence of foreign interference in the U.S. presidential election. Sidney Powell, who had spent the past month filing lawsuits claiming that China and other countries had hacked into voting machines, said she had such evidence, the person said. But Rudy Giuliani was adamant that the military should not be mobilized, the person said, and Donald Trump ultimately heeded his advice. Shortly after the Oval Office meeting, Phil Waldron amended the draft executive order suggesting that if the U.S. Defense Department could not oversee the seizure of machines, then the Department of Homeland Security could, the person said. Around that time, Donald Trump asked Rudy Giuliani to call Kenneth Cusinelli, the acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, to ask about the viability of the proposal, according to two people familiar with the matter. Kenneth Cusinelli said that Homeland Security officials could not take part in the plan. All of this was playing out amid open acrimony among White House aides and outside advisors about how best and how far to proceed with efforts to pursue Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud in the election. That same month, during a meeting on another matter, Donald Trump asked Kenneth Cusinelli what he thought of appointing a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Mr. Cusinelli, according to two people briefed on the conversation, said it was not a good idea for a variety of reasons. When Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne arrived at the White House to discuss their plan to use the military to seize voting machines, they were not let into the Oval Office by a typical gatekeeper like Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff. Rather, they were escorted in by Garrett Ziegler, a young aide to another Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, according to Mr. Ziegler's account. I waved in General Flynn and Sidney Powell on the Friday night of the 18th, for which Mark Meadows' office revoked my guest privileges, Mr. Ziegler said on a podcast, adding that he had done so because he was frustrated with the current counsel that Donald Trump was getting. Even Rudy Giuliani, who had spent weeks peddling some of the most outrageous claims about election fraud, felt that the idea of bringing in the military was beyond the pale. After Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell left the Oval Office, according to a person familiar with the matter, Rudy Giuliani predicted that the plans they were proposing were going to get Donald Trump impeached. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. After the passing away of Imam Khomeini and after his anniversary, this decade of Fajr must show that for the people, the memory of the Imam is as precious as the person of the Imam. Well, if it is decided that the memory of the Imam, like all ordinary memories, will gradually weaken, one day it will disappear. Know this, the day when we in this country do not have the memory of Imam Khomeini, the country will suffer a great loss. You should not let this happen. The memory of Imam, more than ever, is in the decade of Fajr and on the 22nd of Bahman. Even more than the anniversary of the passing away of Imam Khomeini, this commemoration shows his noble personality. This is in fact the birth of the imamate of this country, in the same sense that the imam and Islam themselves have drawn for us. Before that, imam was the leader of the struggle and movement, but from the day he entered the country and formed the Islamic State, he became the imam of the Islamic Ummah. This is more important than the memory of death.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah.
Millions of Iranians across the country have begun 10 days of celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that put an end to the monarchy of the Pahlavi regime in Iran. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on this regard.
The marches of our dear people on different occasions of the revolution, and most importantly on the 22nd of Bahman, are like a rain of mercy that acquaints eyes and hearts with the brilliant truth of the revolution, manifests the greatness of the revolution and the great imam, and brings hope and happiness to friends, and it brings frustration to the enemies. And I thank God Almighty for this great success and grace, thankful, and the people of Iran for this effort, determination, and loyalty. The 22nd of Bahman, an anniversary that is not a dry, formal ceremony. Compare the anniversaries of the revolutions, the anniversaries of the national days in the countries, with this great movement of the people in our dear country. The anniversary of our revolution is not a dry and formal ceremony. It is a 100% popular ceremony. People take part in the severe cold and the scorching heat in all circumstances, where they need to be on the scene, and on the 22nd of Bahman, every year, the people of this field are honored and enter the field and show their presence to all enemies and opponents. This can be seen in the world. The 22nd of Bahman and the 22nd of Bahman March are a manifestation of national authority. It is a manifestation of the authority of the Iranian nation. It is a manifestation of the presence of the people and the national will and determination of the Iranian nation that men, women, old and young, take to the streets in all circumstances and present themselves in front of the eyes of the spectators throughout the country. This is very great.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.